Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do a little more from The Unabridged, The International Jew by Henry Ford, written back in 1920 and 21. And we're talking about Paul Warburg and the foundation of the American financial system under the Federal Reserve. Warburg was from a German Jew banking family, just as were Schiff and Kuhn and Loeb and the rest of these people who came to dominate American finance. And they realized they needed to create a money cartel and have it operate under the auspices of the federal government. So they got the top goy money guy, Senator Aldrich of Rhode Island, and they took him and a few others down in a secret meeting off the coast of Georgia, Jekyll Island, which you can read about at length in The Creature from Jekyll Island by a fellow named Edward Griffin. Read that book if you want the fuller story. But we're going to dig into it a little more today and just see how the Jews came to dominate the money in the United States. They were already the top financiers in Europe, and they extended that to America. And they came here and they found the system old and antiquated, which doesn't mean it didn't work. It means it didn't work to their advantage as well as it could if they created a Federal Reserve that was a private Jewish banking system that operates under the auspices of the government, giving it the appearance of neutrality. And so this is what we're going to read. We heard about some of it in chapter 57, but now we're going to do chapters 58 and 59 and really complete the story. So now we see that chapter 58 is called Jewish Idea Molded Federal Reserve Plan. And then chapter 59, we're going to hear Jewish Idea of Central Bank for America. So it's all about Jews, Paul Warburg in specific, revising the financial system of the United States in order to benefit their tribe, which by definition means hurting our tribe of whites, the people who created America, i.e. the Americans. So, chapter 58, Jewish Idea Molded Federal Reserve Plan. The last view the reader had of Paul M. Warburg in the preceding article, which you can hear us talking about that in at vnnforum.com, chapter 57. The last view the reader had of Paul M. Warburg in the preceding article was as, quote, an alien not naturalized, unquote, secretly closeted with Senator Nelson W. Aldrich and a party of bankers on an obscure island off the southeastern coast of the United States, all the members of the party concealing their identity, even from the servants, by calling each other by their first names. Again, why the secrecy? That conference and its ultimate results was of the utmost importance to the United States, for then and there were formulated those fiscal devices, those financial methods, those, quote, monetary reforms, unquote, which have exerted an influence on every citizen, rich and poor, of the Republic. So, again, they're talking about something that was created in 1913, 14, 15, 16 period. It was institutionalized or instantiated after the creation in 1913. So, this Jew, Warburg, arrives in the U.S. in 1906, and that's when he starts thinking about seriously about banking reform, writing about it, and then talking to people about it. And this is where it becomes reality now. He's the representative of Kuhn and Loeb in the U.S. Much history was made in that little trip. It irresistibly calls to memory that other trip made in 1915, almost 2 years before America's entry into war. And remember, this is being written in 1921 when I'm reading to you, by Bernard Baruch. And remember, we've talked about him in earlier chapters. He was the head of, like, the War Production Board, I think it was, or at least he was the one where the rubber met the road, the guy with the actual institutional power, no matter what his formal position was, who essentially controlled the economy during the war effort that had just ended when they're writing this in 21. So all of this stuff was going on in the 1910 to 1920 period, just a few years before the Dearborn Independent is writing about it. So, much history was made in that little trip to Jekyll Island. It irresistibly calls to memory that other trip made in 1915, almost 2 years before America's entry into war, by Bernard M. Baruch. As readers of the Dearborn Independent of November 27, 1920 will recall, Mr. Baruch had been financial backer of the Plattsburgh camp, and in his testimony he said that he thought that General Wood would admit this. Then, quote, "I went off on a long trip, and it was while on this trip that I felt there ought to be some mobilization of the industries, and I was thinking about the scheme that practically was put into effect and was working when I was chairman of the board. When I came back from that trip, I asked for an interview with the president. The president listened very attentively and graciously, as he always does." Unquote. Mr. Baruch was an authority on the president's demeanor, for there was a long period in 1917 and 1918 during which he called at the White House every afternoon. Two momentous trips in our recent history, both of them signalized and given their principal meaning by the presence of Jews. Not that there should not have been Jews in either case. To insist upon their total exclusion would be going too far. The Jew as a citizen, bearing his part, is one matter. The Jew as a master, directing the national show, is quite another thing. It is by no means agreed that Barney Baruch was the only man in the United States who could have run this nation's war business to the immense profitability of his fellow Jews. That is the explanation made of the high place he took, that he was the only man who could do it. Nonsense! If that be so, let us close up the nation and hand the keys over to the New York Kahilla. Mr. Baruch could say, "I probably had more power than any other man did in the war. Doubtless that is true." But he had that power because he was, for the time, the head in front of the Jewish group for war purposes. If the explanation of Jewish mastery at critical moments were brains, well and good. But if it were, it would be more evident to the people. Brains did not need to be advertised. They advertised themselves. There is another reason. The British public recently awoke to the fact that not Lloyd George, but Mr. Montague and Sir Alfred Mond, M-O-N-D, were in charge of the recent negotiations over the German indemnities. That is, all these advisors at Versailles, the treaty after World War I, were all Jews, and they were the ones who made all the provisions. These gentlemen are both Jews, one of them of German descent. Of all the British Empire, are they the only two men to advise the Premier in a great crisis? If they are, why is it? The Montagues, that's a common Jew cover name, we know, control the silver of the world. The Montagues control the silver. Sir Alfred Mond, we know, turned a very neat trick of keeping the sign of the cross, Christian sign, off the war memorials raised to the soldiers of the empire. Their Jewishness always so apparent. Of course, there's always Star of David is fine. It's the usual double standard. Both financiers, both close advisors of the premier, as Baruch to Wilson, so they to Lloyd George. So always you find this scrum of Jewish advisors in a close, tight ring around the goy fronts person. So the goy mobs and masses are fooled that their kind runs their country, but in fact it's run behind the scenes by a very different personage than is commonly assumed, as Disraeli put it. Apparently there are no Anglo-Saxons on either side of the sea capable of managing these deep matters, if we are to judge from the war administrations. Those that have passed off the stage and those that still linger. Lloyd George, for once stung to the quick by the criticism of the British public of his tendency to closet himself with Jews, when confronted with a crucial question, retorted bitterly, "With what?" With the outworn Jewish propagandist boast that it ill became people who sang Jewish psalms in church to rag the race that wrote them. A most illuminating defense. The world would give a good deal for a true psalm from Sir Alfred Mond, Mr. Montague, or even Sir Philip Sassoon, who is soon to become the Premier's son-in-law. In our own history, Barney Baruch boldly claims his place. He unhesitatingly asserts that he had more power than any other man in the war. If Allenby in Palestine needed a locomotive, if the Americans in Russia needed clothing, if the munition mills needed copper, it was Baruch who gave or withheld the word. Mr. Warburg, being of a somewhat finer grain, probably due to his having less than Mr. Baruch of the rough experience of the street, does not make the claim that he is the chief factor in the present monetary system of the United States, nor does the Dearborn Independent undertake to make it for him, lest the cry of anti-Semitism wax wrathful again. but fortunately the fact is amply attested by a Jew whose knowledge of the matter is unquestionable, that Warburg is the real power behind the Fed. Readers have doubtless become aware by this time that for a non-Jew to say that a certain Jew is a most important factor in any field is to be guilty of anti-Semitism, while for a Jew or a Gentile front to say it is perfectly proper. It is a rather odd etiquette in which simple minds sometimes become confused. Professor E.R.A. Seligman of Columbia University is the sponsor of this great honor for Mr. Warburg. What Professor Seligman says is of such importance, both as to its source and its subject, that quotation is justified. The italics in all cases are ours. Quote, "It is in a general way known to the public that Mr. Warburg was in some way connected with the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, and his appointment to his present responsible position on the Federal Reserve Board was acclaimed on all sides with a rare degree of approval and congratulation. But I fancy it is known only to a very few how great is the indebtedness of the United States to Mr. Warburg. For it may be stated without fear of contradiction that in its fundamental features, the Federal Reserve Act is the work of Mr. Warburg more than of any other man in the country." So that's what Seligman of Columbia says. And continuing the quote, "When the Aldrich Commission was appointed, it was not long before Senator Aldrich, to his credit be it said, was won over by Mr. Warburg to the adoption of these two fundamental features. The Aldrich bill differed in some important particulars from the present law. The concession in the shape of the 12 regional banks that had to be made for political reasons is, in the opinion of Mr. Warburg, as well as the writer of this introduction, a mistake. For it will probably, to some extent at least, weaken the good results which would otherwise have followed. On the other hand, the existence of a Federal Reserve Board creates, in everything but in name, a real central bank, and it depends so largely upon the wisdom with which the Board exercises its great powers as to whether we shall be able to secure most of the advantages of a central bank without any of its dangers." So it sounds like the Jews would rather have it just simply have one central bank rather than have 12 regional banks, and that's more of an administrative flowchart fiction than a reality. But nevertheless, it presents at least a minor obstacle the Jews have to work around that they don't particularly like. Quote, continuing with a quote from the Seligman, "In many minor respects, also, the Federal Reserve Act differs from the Aldrich Bill, but in the two fundamentals of combined reserves and of a discount policy, the Federal Reserve Act has frankly accepted the principles of the Aldrich Bill, and these principles, as has been stated, were the creation of Mr. Warburg and of Mr. Warburg alone." So the Fed is the guarantor of last resort, and it loans money to these banks at a discount, and it basically has control over the printing of the money and the terms at which that money is lent. Continuing the quote, "It must not be forgotten that Mr. Warburg had a practical object in view. In formulating his plans, and in advancing slightly varying suggestions from time to time, it was incumbent on him to remember that the education of the country must be gradual, and that a large part of the task was to break down prejudices and remove suspicions. His plans, therefore, contain all sorts of elaborate suggestions designed to guard the public against fancied dangers, and to persuade the country that the general scheme was at all practicable. It was the hope of Mr. Warburg that, with the lapse of time, it might be possible to eliminate from the law not a few clauses which were inserted, largely at his suggestion, for educational purposes." Continuing the quotation, "As it was my privilege to say to President Wilson when originally urging the appointment of Mr. Warburg in the Federal Reserve Board, at a time when the political prejudice against New York bankers ran very high, England also, 3/4 of a century ago, had a practical banker who was virtually responsible for the idea contained in Peel's Bank Act of 1840. Mr. Samuel Jones Lloyd was honored as a consequence by the British government and was made a Lord Overstone. The United States was equally fortunate in having with it a Lord Overstone," by which he means Warburg. Final quote from Seligman, professor at Columbia. "The Federal Reserve Act will be associated in history with the name of Paul M. Warburg. And this long series of quotations was taken from pages 387 to 390 of Volume 4, Number 4, Proceedings of the Academy of Political Science, Columbia University. Back to Ford now. It surely cannot be considered invidious for the Dearborn Independent thus to introduce to the people of the United States a gentleman whose influence upon the country is so vital, and vital, as I was screamed at by a professor in college and assuring that I would remember it, vital means life or death. It doesn't mean trivial or tangential or in any way small. It means life or death, coming from the root word for life, vital. Warburg's influence upon the United States is vital. Just how vital can be understood only by those who have studied the puzzle of a country filled with the good things of life and still unable to use them or to share them because of a kink in the pipeline called, quote-unquote, money. But that Mr. Warburg himself is not entirely unaware of his position is indicated on page 56 of his testimony last week. Quoted last week, Mr. Warburg had just told the Senate committee that he was making a heavy financial sacrifice to accept the position on the Federal Reserve Board offered him by President Wilson, and into the fitness of which appointment the Senate was carefully inquiring. Transcript: Senator Reed, may I ask what your motive is, or your reason for making that sacrifice? Mr. Warburg, my motive is that I have, as you know, taken a keen interest in this monetary reform since I have been in this country. Quote, I have had the success which comes to few people of starting an idea and starting it so that the whole country has taken it up and it has taken some tangible form. Professor Seligman advises us of the strategy that was used to get the whole country to take up Mr. Warburg's idea, and of the fact that some of the items inserted to appease the public might easily be removed when the public shall have become accustomed to Mr. Warburg and the Federal Reserve Board, but Mr. Warburg adds another hint to the effect that you can do some things by administration which you cannot do by organization. For example, Mr. Warburg wanted only one central bank, which should be the sole arbiter of finance in the United States. Professor Seligman advises us of the strategy that was used to get the whole country to take up Mr. Warburg's idea, and of the fact that some of the items inserted to appease the public might easily be removed when the public shall have become accustomed to Mr. Warburg and the Federal Reserve Board. But Mr. Warburg adds another hint to the effect that you can do some things by administration which you cannot do by organization. I'm repeating, but it's important. For example, Warburg wanted only one central bank, not 12 regional banks, which should be the sole arbiter of finance in the United States. The U.S. government would have almost nothing to do save to make the money and stand in back of it. The bankers of the U.S. and the people thereof would have nothing to do except what they were told. The one central bank would be the real financial governing authority. When asked by Senator Bristow to state the fundamental difference between the Aldrich plan and the present Federal Reserve plan, Mr. Warburg replied, well, the Aldrich bill brings the whole system into one unit, while this deals with 12 units and unites them again into the Federal Reserve Board. It is a little bit complicated, which objection, however, can be overcome in an administrative way, and in that respect I freely criticized the bill before it was passed. There is evidently, then, a method of administration for which severe critics might even use the word manipulation, by which the plain provisions of a banking law, whatever they may be, if not evaded, then somewhat adapted. This idea is brought to mind by a more colloquial expression of Mr. Warburg's to be found in his address on bank acceptance delivered in 1919. Block quote. In this connection, I am reminded of a story I once heard concerning a man belonging to a species now soon to be extinct due to prohibition, and to be found by our children only in Webster's dictionary, only the bartender. A man of this profession in prehistoric times was abandoning his position and was turning over his cash register to his successor. Please show me how it works, said the newcomer. I will show you how it works, said the other, but I won't show you how to work it. I will show you how it works, but I won't show you how to work it. So there's what it does formally, and then there's the way it can actually be used. the politics of Mr. Warburg and the firm of Kuhn Loeb and Company form part of the inquiry, and Mr. Warburg made some interesting revelations which illustrate the oft-repeated statement that it is part of Jewish policy, perhaps of large financial firms generally, to attach themselves to both parties so that certain interests may be the winners regardless of which party is defeated. That is, Jews bet on all horses, whether financially or politically. Again, more transcript from Senate hearing. Senator Pomerene, P-O-M-E-R-E-N-E, what are your politics? Senator Nelson, no, we have not raised that before this committee. Senator Reed, it has not been raised here, but I should like to know. Senator Pomerene, it has been raised before the Senate. Senator Reed, I will say why I should like to know. Senator Pomerene, well, I have no objection to saying what was in my own mind. The chairman, I will say that I do not know what Mr. Warburg's policies are, politics are. Pomerene, well, I did not. Senator Shafroth, I do not know and I do not care to know. S-H-A-F-R-O-T-H. Pomerene, I heard the statement made that the entire board was Democratic, and I had understood that Mr. Warburg was a Republican or had been in his affiliations. Mr. Warburg, well, so I was, and my sympathies were entirely in the early campaign for Mr. Taft against Mr. Roosevelt in the first fight. When later on Mr. Roosevelt became President Wilson's opponent, my sympathies went with Mr. Wilson. Reed, Senator Reed, well, you would count yourself a Republican, generally speaking. Mr. Warburg, I would. Bristow, it has been variously reported in the newspapers that you and your partners directly and indirectly contributed very largely to Mr. Wilson's campaign funds. Mr. Warburg, well, my partners, there is a very peculiar condition. No, I do not think any one of them contributed largely at all. There may have been moderate contributions. My brother, for instance, contributed to Mr. Taft's campaign. Senator Bristow, just what would you consider a moderate contribution to a campaign? Mr. Warburg, well, that depends who the man is who contributes, but I think anything below $10,000 or $5,000 would not be an extravagant contribution, so far as that should be. Parentheses, examination resumed another day. Bristow, Senator Bristow. Now, Mr. Warburg, when we closed Saturday, some senator asked you in regard to political contributions, and I understood you to say that you contributed to Mr. Wilson's campaign. Mr. Warburg, no. My letter says that I offered to contribute, but it was too late. I came back to this country only a few days before the campaign closed. Bristow, so that you did not make any contribution? I did not make any contribution, no. Did any members of your firm make contributions to Mr. Wilson's campaign? I think that is a matter of record. Mr. Schiff contributed, says Warburg. I would not otherwise discuss the contributions of my partners if it was not a matter of record. I think Mr. Schiff was the only one who contributed in our firm. Bristow, and you stated that your brother had contributed to Mr. Taft's campaign, as I understand it. Mr. Warburg, I did, but again, I do not want to go into discussion of my partner's affairs, and I shall stick to that pretty strictly, or we will never get through. Bristow, I understood you also to say that no members of your firm contributed to Mr. Roosevelt's campaign. Mr. Warburg, I did not say that. Senator Bristow, oh, did any members of the firm do that? Mr. Warburg, my answer would please you probably, but I shall not answer that, but will repeat that I will not discuss my partner's affairs. Senator Bristow, yes, I understood you to say Saturday that you were a Republican, but when Mr. Roosevelt became a candidate, you then became a sympathizer with Mr. Wilson and supported him. Mr. Warburg, yes. While your brother was supporting Mr. Taft. Mr. Warburg, yes. Senator Bristow, and I was interested to know whether any member of your firm supported Mr. Roosevelt. Mr. Warburg, it is a matter of record that there are. That there are some of them who did. Oh, yes. Will you please indicate, or do you care to indicate, what members of your firm supported Mr. Roosevelt in that campaign? Mr. Warburg, no, sir. I shall have to go on the principle that I cannot disclose the business of a member of my firm. So, the Jews are playing all ends, is what is being evoked here, brought out. The result was this, says Ford, that in a three-cornered fight between three candidates, Roosevelt, Taft, and Wilson, the men who constituted the firm of Kuhn Loeb and Company, chief Jewish financial institution of the United States, distributed their support among all three. Schiff for Wilson, Felix Warburg for Taft, and an unknown for Roosevelt. Was that unknown Mr. Kahn? In any case, Otto Hermann Kahn. In any case, Wilson won, and the above examination relates to a member of the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company receiving an important appointment that gave him a large power over the finances of the United States. Jews bet on all horses. No matter what you want, the Jew middleman tries to get between you and it and sell it to you and mediate it for you. The point of not discussing the affairs of Kuhn, Loeb & Company was frequently made by Mr. Warburg. Quote, I cannot discuss the affairs of the firm nor my partners, nor be asked to criticize acts of my partners, either to approve them or in any other way. I would like to say that before we come to the point where I would feel that I should not answer any questions, said Mr. Warburg. The principle of this objection was conceded by the Senate committee, but that it ought to serve as a blanket injunction against a number of pertinent inquiries was doubted. Again, more from the transcript. Bristow, Senator Bristow, but are you a partner in this firm, and have you not had something to do with its operations and its management? Yes, says Warburg. Does that not go to show your general views and practices as a financier and as a citizen and as a businessman? Yes, but you've got to take them individually. I cannot permit my firm to be drawn into this discussion. Bristow, but how can you divest yourself from your firm when you have been one of the managers of the firm? I shall divest myself of the firm. If the firm has done something I might think was improper, to illustrate, being called upon to say whether or not I approve your nomination to this responsible position, have I not a right to know what your attitude was with regard to that transaction which your firm performed? Mr. Warburg, well, inasmuch as my answer there might be a criticism of my firm, I would beg to be excused, and I would leave it to the committee to draw its own conclusions. In examining Mr. Warburg about the handling of $100 million Southern Pacific securities, the same difficulty was experienced. Mr. Warburg objected, but we are getting here again into the transactions of my firm. To which Senator Bristow retorted, ah, but when you participated in the profits of the transaction, is it not a part of your business life? Mr. Warburg, certainly it is a part of my business life, and there is no reason why I should not be proud of it. But as a matter of principle, I think we should not get into a discussion of the business of my firm. Senator Bristow, I am discussing your business. Mr. Warburg, no, you are discussing the firm's business. Senator Bristow, did you get any of the profits that came from the handling of the $100 million? Mr. Warburg, you may take it that whatever my firm did, I got my profits, my share in the profits. Bristow, your share in the profits. Now, without being specific, I take it for granted that this was quite material, that was quite a material interest in size, that it's a lot of money. That is, that you were one of the important members of the firm. I am one of the important members of the firm. Yes, I think the testimony in the report here show that you are the third important member, or is it the second? Which is it of the firm? Mr. Warburg, we are not numbered. You are not. All right. There is Mr. Jacob H. Schiff, who is the senior, says Warburg. Yes. And the others rank very much alike. Senator Bristow, yes, we may take it for granted then that whatever profits accrue to your firm in the handling of this business here, since you became a member of it, you participated in the profits as one of the partners. Mr. Warburg, yes, sir. Senator Bristow, yes. So I will assume then, of course, that you participated in the marketing of the $113 million of Union Pacific and so on. Ford again. The responsibilities of a member of the Federal Reserve Board, especially such a member as Paul M. Warburg, would be, for it was recognized that because of his purpose and connections he would become a dominating factor, were very great, especially at the time when the appointment was being considered. They are as important now, of course, but in a different way. It is not now a question of military safety. This thought was evidently in the mind of the senators, as the following shows. Senator Hitchcock, Mr. Warburg, one of the important functions of the board is to guard the gold supply of the country, and it has been thought that it is very important to have men on board who have at heart only the interests of the United States and had no foreign interests or alliances. You have said that you propose to divest yourself altogether of your banking connections in Germany. Have you any other interests in Europe? No, not to speak of, said Mr. Warburg. I may have very unimportant things, like everybody has, but I could dispose of those. It would not amount to anything. Senator Hitchcock, nothing in the line of banking? Mr. Warburg, no. A few moments later, the chairman, Senator Owen, said, the date was August 1st, 1914, we are on the eve of a great European war, and the organization of this board is of great national importance. At this time, Mr. Warburg was, we're just about to go to war with Germany, and they're going to appoint this guy to be on the Federal Reserve, and he has a huge banking interest in someone we're going to be at war with, perhaps. At this time, Mr. Warburg was a member of the Hamburg firm. He testified, page 7, I am going to leave my Hamburg firm, though the law does not require me to do so. A part of the German firm of his father and brothers, a part of the American firm to which he and his brother were related by marital, married to the Loebs, as well as financial ties, Mr. Warburg repeatedly said he would break off all business relationships so that he, like Caesar's wife, to quote himself, should be above suspicion. And that's the end of that portion about Warburg, chapter 58, which appeared the 25th of June, 1921. And then moving on immediately into chapter 59, which also deals further with Warburg and the Federal Reserve. Chapter 59 is the Jewish idea of central bank for America. Why do they want centralized politics? Why are the Jews against states' rights? Because they want everything controlled from one point, because it's easier for a small number of people to have leverage in one capital rather than 50 state capitals. It's easier for them to force through a Gleichschaltung, that is a coordination of all policies. If everybody is subject to the TV model, where a few people produce it and everybody consumes the same thing, it's easier for them to centralize, collectivize, and force one standard for everybody. And a certain type of goyish mind, the population seems roughly split between people who like that way of doing things and people who don't, who instinctively prefer a peer-to-peer or more open sort of system. But really, whites are the only racial group that's capable of decentralization, either as an ideal or as just a something that fits them more naturally, rather than having a dictator to tell them how to live every little jot and tittle of their lives. Anyway, not getting farther afield on that, Jewish idea of central bank for America, chapter 59. According to his own statements and the facts, Paul M. Warburg set out to reform the monetary system of the United States, and did so. He had the success which comes to few men of coming as an alien to the United States, connecting himself with the principal Jewish financial firm here, Kuhn and Loeb, and immediately floating certain banking ideas which had been pushed and manipulated and variously adapted until they eventuated in what is known as the Federal Reserve System. When Professor Seligman wrote in the Proceedings of the Academy of Political Science that the Federal Reserve Act will be associated in history with the name of Paul M. Warburg, a Jewish banker from Germany, he wrote the truth. But whether that association will be such as to bring the measure of renown, which Professor Seligman implies, the future will reveal. And of course, hardly had it been created than it caused the Great Depression, which, in every formal approved text of economics that I've ever heard of, is attributed to the business and capitalism, but in fact it was caused by the Fed. Although there is a Jew who tells the truth about that, and that is the late Murray Rothbard. But other than that, it's always blamed on the business community rather than the Fed pumping money out and distorting the economy. What the people of the United States do not understand, and never have understood, is that while the Federal Reserve Act was governmental, that is, it was pushed through the government, the formal legislative channels, the people who make laws, the Congress, the whole Federal Reserve System is private. So a federal act created a private system that has monopoly power, has cartel power over money. It can dilute the power of money that is now unbacked, is purely floating paper money, and it doesn't allow any competition. Well, what happens when competition is forbidden? Now you get whatever the people, the dictators choose to give you. And they're going to give you stuff on terms highly favorable to themselves. Whereas if they had honest competition, if they had competition, they wouldn't be able to get away with it because everyone would see that they're diluting their dollars, and they would go with a hard form of currency. What we see as I talk today is stuff like Bitcoin popping up. And even though it has some problems, it offers something that can't be falsified. You see, you cannot trust human beings, but you can always trust that human greed will be there. And there's no form of regulation that works other than competition, unfortunately. I mean, short of killing people. And that can be perverted too. Anyhow, while the Federal Reserve Act was governmental, the Federal Reserve System is private. It is an officially created private banking system. Examine the first 1,000 persons you meet on the street, and 999 will tell you that the Federal Reserve System is a device whereby the United States government went into the banking business for the benefit of the people. They have an idea that, like the post office and the custom house, a Federal Reserve Bank is a part of the government's official machinery. It is natural to feel that this mistaken view has been encouraged by most of the men who are competent to write for the public on this question. Take up the standard encyclopedias, and while you will find no misstatements of fact in them, you will find no direct statement that the Federal Reserve System is a private banking system. The impression carried away by the lay reader is that it is part of the government. Again, taken in by names. Federal Reserve System sounds governmental. The Federal Reserve System is a system of private banks, the creation of a banking aristocracy within an already existing autocracy, whereby a great proportion of banking independence was lost, and whereby it was made possible for speculative financiers to centralize great sums of money for their own purposes, beneficial or not. Essentially, they're allowed to gamble in the stock market, and if they lose, then the feds make it up, as we saw, 2008. That this system was useful in the artificial conditions created by war, useful, that is, for a government that cannot manage its own business and finances, and, like a prodigal son, is always wanting money and wanting it when it wants it, it is proved, either by reason of its inherent faults or by mishandling, its inadequacy to the problems of peace. It has sadly failed of its promise and is now under serious question. And, of course, this is before the Great Depression, so a lot of the material he could really have used against this thing when it was just larval and just getting started had not happened yet. We only know it from 100 years hindsight. Mr. Warburg's scheme succeeded just in time to take care of war conditions. He was placed on the Federal Reserve Board in order to manage his system and practice, and though he was full of ideas then as to how banking could be assisted, he is disappointingly silent as to how the people can be relieved. However, this is not a discussion of the Federal Reserve System. General condemnation of it would be stupid. But it is bound to come up for discussion one day, and the discussion will become much freer when people understand that it is a system of privately owned banks to which have been delegated certain extraordinary privileges, and that it has created a class system within the banking world which constitutes a new order. Mr. Warburg, it will be remembered, wanted only one central bank. But because of political considerations, as Professor Seligman tells us, 12 were decided upon. An examination of Mr. Warburg's printed discussions of the subject shows that he at one time considered 4, then 8. Eventually, 12 were established. The reason was that one central bank, which naturally would be set up in New York, would give a suspicious country the impression that it was only a new scheme to keep the nation's money flowing to New York. As shown by Professor Seligman, quoted in the last number, Mr. Warburg was not averse to granting anything that would allay popular suspicion without vitiating the real plan. Vitiating meaning weakening. So, while admitting to the senators who examined him as to his fitness for membership on the Federal Reserve Board, the board which fixed the policies of the banks of the Federal Reserve System and told them what to do, that he did not like the 12 district banks idea. He said that his objections to it could be, quote, overcome in an administrative way. That is, the 12 banks could be so handled that the effect would be the same as if there were only one central bank, presumably in New York. So it's merely a paper dispersion of power. And in reality, is it all runs through one central channel, the Bank of New York. And that is about the way it has resulted. And that will be found to be one of the reasons for the present situation of the country. There is no lack of money in New York today. Motion picture ventures are being financed into the millions. A big grain selling pool, nursed into existence and counseled by Bernard M. Baruch, has no hesitancy whatever in planning for a $100 million corporation. Lowe, as in Lowe's Theaters, the Jewish theatrical man, had no difficulty in opening 20 new theaters this year. But go into the agricultural states, where the real wealth of the country is in the ground and in the granaries, and you cannot find money for the farmer. It is a situation which none can deny and which few can explain, because the explanation is not to be found along natural lines. Natural conditions are always easiest to explain. Unnatural conditions wear an air of mystery. Here is the United States, the richest country in the world, containing at the present hour the greatest bulk of wealth to be found anywhere on earth, real, available, usable wealth, and yet it is tied up tight and cannot move in its legitimate channels because of manipulation which is going on as regards money. Money is the last mystery for the popular mind to penetrate, and when it succeeds in getting, quote, on the inside, unquote, it will discover that the mystery is not in money at all, but in its manipulation, the things which are done, quote, in an administrative way, unquote. The United States has never had a president who gave evidence of understanding this matter at all. Our presidents have always had to take their views from financiers. Money is the most public quantity in the country. It is the most federalized and governmentalized thing in the country. And yet in the present situation, the United States government has hardly anything to do with it, except to use various means to get it, just as the people have to get it from those who control it. The money question, properly solved, is the end of the Jewish question and every other question of a mundane nature. Mr. Warburg is of the opinion that different rates of interest ought to obtain in different parts of the country. That they have always obtained in different parts of the same state, we have always known, but the reason for it has not been discovered. The city grocer can get money from his bank at a lower rate than the farmer in the next county can get it from his bank. Why the agricultural rate of interest has been higher than any other, when money is obtainable, it is not obtainable now, is a question to which no literary nor oratorical financier has ever publicly addressed himself. It is like the fact of the private business nature of the Federal Reserve System, very important, but no authority thinks it worth his while to state. The agricultural rate of interest is of great importance, but to discuss it would involve first an admission, and that apparently is not desirable. In comparing the present Federal Reserve law with the proposed Aldrich bill, Mr. Warburg, block quote here, I think that this present law has the advantage of dealing with the entire country and giving them different rates of discount, whereas, as Senator Aldrich's bill was drawn, it would have been very difficult to do that, as it provided for one uniform rate for the whole country, which I thought was rather a mistake. Senator Bristow. That is, you can charge a higher rate of interest in one section of the country under the present law than you charge in another section, while under the Aldrich plan, it would have been a uniform rate. Mr. Warburg, that is correct. Says Ford, that is a point worth clearing up. If Mr. Warburg, having educated the bankers, will now turn his attention to the people and make it clear why one class in the country can get money for business that is not productive of real wealth, while another class engaged in the production of real wealth is treated as outside the interest of banking altogether, that is, farmers versus like movie theater people, while to another class in another section it is sold at a different price. He will be adding to the people's grasp of these matters. This suggestion is seriously intended. Mr. Warburg has the style, the pedagogical patience, the grasp of the subject which would make him an admirable public teacher of these matters. What he has already done was planned from the point of view of the interest of the professional financier. It is readily granted that Mr. Warburg desired to organize American finances into a more pliable system. Doubtless, in some respects, he has wrought important improvements. But he had always the banking house in mind, and he dealt with paper. Now, if taking up a position outside those special interests, i.e. on the Federal Reserve Board, he would address himself to the wider interests of the people, not assuming that those interests always run through a banking house, he would do still more than he has done yet to justify his feeling that he really had a mission in coming to this country, beyond enriching himself and his tribe. Mr. Warburg is not at all shocked by the idea that the Federal Reserve System is really a new kind of private banking control, because in his European experience, he saw that all the central banks were private affairs. In his essay on, quote, American and European banking methods and bank legislation compared, unquote, Mr. Warburg says, the italics are ours. It may also be interesting to note that, italics, contrary to a widespread idea, the central banks of Europe are, as a rule, not owned by the governments. End italics. As a matter of fact, neither the English, French, nor German government owns any stock in the central bank of its country. The Bank of England is run entirely as a private corporation, in italics. The stockholders electing the board of directors who rotate in holding the presidency. In France, the government appoints the governor and some of the directors. In Germany, the government appoints the president and a supervisory board of 5 members, while stockholders elect the board of directors. And again, in his discussion of the Owen Glass Bill, Mr. Warburg says, the Monetary Commission's plan proceeded on the theory of the Bank of England, which leaves the management entirely in the hands of businessmen, without giving the government any part in the management or control. That's all in italics. The strong argument in favor of this theory is that central banking, like any other banking, is based on sound credit, that the judging of credits is a matter of business, that which should be left in the hands of businessmen, italics, and that the government should be kept out of the business, end italics. The Owen Glass Bill proceeds in this respect more on the lines of the Banque de France and the German Reichsbank, and the presidents and boards of which are, to a certain extent, appointed by the government. These central banks, while legally private corporations, are semi-governmental organs inasmuch as they are permitted to issue the notes of the nation, particularly where there are elastic note issues, as in almost all countries except England, and inasmuch as they are the custodians of practically the entire metallic reserves of the country and the keepers of the government funds. Moreover, in questions of national policy, the government must rely on the willing and loyal cooperation of these central organs. That is a very illuminating passage, says Ford. It will well be worth the reader's time, especially the reader who is always puzzled by financial matters, to turn over in his mind the facts here given by a great Jewish financial expert about the central bank. Observe the phrases. A. Without giving the government any part in the management or control. B. These central banks, while legally private corporations, are permitted to issue the notes of the nation. C. They are custodians of practically the entire metallic reserves of the nation and the keepers of the government funds. D. In questions of national policy, the government must rely on the willing and loyal cooperation. Of these central organs. It is not now a question of whether these things are right or wrong, It is merely a question of understanding that they constitute the fact. It is especially notable that in paragraph D, it is a fair deduction that in questions of national policy, the government will simply have to depend not only on the patriotism, but also to an extent on the permission and counsel of the financial organizations. That is a fair interpretation. Questions of national policy are, by this method, rendered dependent upon the financial corporations. Let that point be clear. Quite regardless of the question whether or not this is a good idea, the way national policy should be determined, that is the fact, that is how it's done. Mr. Warburg said that he believed in a certain amount of governmental control, but not too much. He said, in strengthening the government control, the Owen-Glass bill, therefore, moved in the right direction, but it went too far and fell into the other and even more dangerous extreme. The, quote, more dangerous extreme, unquote, was, of course, the larger measure of government supervision provided for and the establishment of a number of Federal Reserve banks out in the country. Mr. Warburg had referred to this before. He had agreed to the larger number only because it seemed to be an unavoidable political concession. It has already been shown by Professor Seligman, long quote last chapter, that Mr. Warburg was alive to the necessity of veiling a little here and there, and putting a little on yonder, for the sake of conciliating a suspicious public. There was also the story of the bartender and the cash register. This is how it works formally, and I'm not going to tell you how it works informally. It's the point of his little apophthegm. Mr. Warburg thinks that he understands the psychology of America. In this respect, he reminds one of the reports of Mr. von Bernstorff and Captain Boyed, B-O-Y-ED, of what the Americans were likely to do or not to do. In the Political Science Quarterly of December 1920, Mr. Warburg tells how, on a then-recent visit to Europe, he was asked by men of all countries what the United States was going to do. He assured them that America was a little tired just then, but that she would come round all right. And then, harking back to his efforts of placing his monetary system on the Americans, he said, I asked them to be patient with us until after the election, and I cited to them our experiences with monetary reform. I reminded them how the Aldrich plan had failed because at that time a Republican president had lost control of a Congress ruled by a Democratic majority, how the Democrats in their platform damned this plan and any central banking system, and how, once in full power, the National Reserve Association was evolved, not to say camouflaged by them, into the Federal Reserve System. Remembering this play before the public, and the play behind the scenes, this camouflaging, as Mr. Warburg says, of one thing into another, he undertook to assure his friends in Europe that, regardless of what the political platform said, the United States would do substantially what Europe hoped it would. Mr. Warburg's basis for that belief was, as he said, his experience with the way the central bank idea went through in spite of the advertised objection of all parties. He believes that with Americans it is possible to get what you want if you just play the game skillfully. His experience with monetary reform seems to have fathered that belief in him. Politicians may be necessary pawns to play in the game, but as members of the government, Mr. Warburg does not want them in banking. They are not bankers, he says. They don't understand. Banking is nothing for a government man to meddle with. He may be good enough for the government of the United States. He is not good enough for banking, which is actually the truth, and it's the same with health care and pretty much everything else other than maintaining physical power, which is where the government has proven itself as a gang. In everything else, it's comparatively not qualified. That's the truth. In our country, says Mr. Warburg, W-A-R-B-U-R-G, referring to the United States, with every untrained amateur a candidate for office, where friendship or help in a presidential campaign, financial or political, has always given a claim for political preferment, where the bids for votes and public favor are ever present in the politician's mind, a direct government management, that is to say a political management, would prove fatal. There can be no doubt but that, as drawn at present, 1913, With two cabinet officers members of the Federal Reserve Board and with vast powers vested in the latter, the Owen-Glass bill, Owen-Glass bill, will bring about direct government management. So this has always been the argument used by the Fed, that it's non-political. They're managing the money in the best interests of the American children, but it's not true. And since no government is going to be particularly honest, it should be opened up to competition and let banks loan whatever money they want at whatever rates they want, and let the borrower beware and not have any guarantees anywhere beyond what the buyer thinks is necessary, so that if one bank fails, it doesn't bring down the whole system and the rest of us are not forced to subsidize these banks who speculate with our money, and it's unavoidable because they are federally chartered. The point is not that they're privately owned. The point is that the government created this monopoly system, and monopoly works as poorly there as it does everywhere else. You need to have a currency competition in order to keep people playing straight. Now, and that's just what something like these encrypted currencies like Bitcoin threaten to bring about, because there's no way to counterfeit them, which is the standing problem where you have government or even government-chartered private control and the disallowing of any competition. So Warburg does not want direct government management. He says, in his mind, that's not only dangerous, quote, but fatal, quote. Mr. Warburg had almost his whole will in the matter. And what was the result? That is, he got whatever he wanted. Basically, he got what he wanted. And what was the result? Turn to the testimony of Bernard M. Baruch when he was examined with reference to the charge that certain men close to President Wilson had profited to the extent of $60 million on stock market operations, which they entered into on the strength of advance information, that would be called insider information today, of what the president was to say in his next war note. The famous, quote, leak, unquote, investigation, as it was called, one of the several investigations in which Mr. Baruch was closely questioned. In that investigation, Mr. Baruch was laboring to show that he had not been in telephone communication with Washington, especially with certain men who were supposed to have shared the profits of the deals, and this is inevitable. There's always going to be insider trading because the information of great value is always going to be known to some people, not others, and there's no way to keep up with that with regulation like the idiots think. And people who believe in regulatory power are just as simple-minded as those who believe in Jesus, and actually more dangerous to your private welfare and income than are those Jesus nuts. Now, as I like to say, the competition is the only regulation that works, because competition forces businesses to keep their eye on the people that they are serving. And then the communists say, well, they're trying to make a profit. Well, yes, they are trying to make a profit. But why is that a bad thing? Because that's an actual, real, admitted goal. But the way they make their profit is by giving other people things that they want. He says, and the communist, the socialist-minded, weak-minded says, well, they're not driven by a higher motive. Well, it's very easy to say that one is driven by a higher motive, but there's no guarantee one actually is. The Soviets were not able to create a new Aryan man. They had to employ slave labor. Whatever idealism there was among the naive goyim who joined the organized Jews who created the Soviet Revolution, burned off very, very quickly when they saw the reality of the situation. What do you think? Capitalism, or let's better put the market, does not claim to be some kind of high ideal. What it claims is that it satisfies ordinary human wants and desires by finding the right point between the supplier and the person who's demanding it, so both sides get what they want. It's mutually profitable trade. Okay, that's in the real world, that's what actually works. This idea that you're going to create a new kind of person who isn't greedy or who does things purely for higher motives is it ain't so. And the minute you create a centralized cartel like this bank they've set up, why, it's not 5 minutes and people are profiting off of it, you see. And it will always be thus. There is no way of regulating it where people aren't going. It's like if you leave your wallet sitting on top of your car, someone's going to grab it. It doesn't matter that they shouldn't do that because that's theft. It's going to happen. So you don't do that. And you don't create a situation where people are going to continually have this inside information. That's maybe not the best example, because what they're going to do with the centralized banking money is they're going to claim that they are neutral scientific managers of the money interest in the name of the people, but what they're actually going to do is deal to themselves. And they're going to print new money and give it to their people so that they benefit from it, and it's going to steal purchasing power from you. And that will always happen. Even if you have an all-white society, if it's still run in the name of whites, how many of those whites are going to be honest and idealistic? Well, take a look at something like what happened to National Alliance after Pierce. Pierce was reasonably honest, but when Pierce left, what happened? Why, someone incapable, who was even more or less appointed by a board that Pierce picked, basically sold off the assets for the benefit of himself and his cronies and drove the thing into the ground. And often as not, that's what's going to happen. Even if you have something that's ostensibly these people are operating in the name of what's good for whites, or what's good for their particular group, but in reality, they're operating in the name of what's good for me. You see? Selfless people are comparatively rare in this world. And you can't rely on regulation, because regulation relies on the principle there are some men who are comparative angels versus other men, when in fact all men are more or less the same. They're fairly easy corruptible generally, and there's no way to get around that, because the nature of the beast ain't going to change anytime soon. Maybe it will with genetic manipulation at some point. They're getting closer on that, but for right now, the substrate called man is pretty darn corruptible, and that includes Aryan man as well as Jews and other forms of hominid. And there's no point in denying that, because it's been found to be that way through all recorded history. So be realistic. Competition is what will protect people. Make the man bear the weight of his own bad choices, so that if he invests in the wrong bank, he gets screwed and you don't by having to bail him out. That will keep everything tight. Okay, so let's go back to that paragraph. Turn to the testimony of Bernard M. Baruch when he was examined with reference to the charge that certain men close to President Wilson had profited to the extent of $60 million on stock market operations, which they entered into on the strength of advance information of what the president was to say in his next war note. And again, remember how Rothschild got rich by knowing the result of the Napoleon at Waterloo before anyone else, hinting the other way and then buying everything up. Here we have the Jews around Wilson knowing what he's going to say and using that inside information to their advantage. In that investigation, Mr. Baruch was laboring to show that he had not been in telephone communication with Washington, especially with certain men who were supposed to have shared the profits of the deals. The time was December 1916. Mr. Warburg was then safely settled on the Federal Reserve Board, which he had kept quite safe from government intrusion. The chairman. Of course, this is more transcript. Of course, the records of the telephone company here, the slips, will show the persons with whom you talked. Do you wish me to say, sir, says Mr. Baruch, I will state who they are. Chairman. Yes, I think you might. Mr. Baruch. I called up two persons. One, Mr. Warburg, whom I did not get, and one, Secretary McAdoo, whom I did get, both in reference to the same matter. Would you like to know the matter? Chairman, yes, I think it fair that you should state it. Mr. Baruch, I called up the Secretary because someone suggested to me, asked me to suggest an officer for the Federal Reserve Bank, and I called him in reference to that and discussed the matter with him, I think two or three times. But it was suggested to me that I make the suggestion, and so I did. Mr. Baruch, says Mr. Campbell, Senator Campbell, Mr. Baruch, who asked you for a suggestion for an appointee to the Federal Reserve Bank here? Mr. Baruch, Mr. E.M. House. Mr. Campbell, did Mr. House tell you to call Mr. McAdoo up and make the recommendation? Mr. Baruch, I will tell you exactly how it occurred, colon. Mr. House called me up and said that there was a vacancy on the Federal Reserve Board, and he said, I don't know anything about those fellows down there, and I would like you to make a suggestion. And I suggested the name, which he thought was a very good one, and he said to me, "I wish you would call up the secretary and tell him." I said, "I do not see the necessity. I will tell you." "No," he said, "I would prefer you call him up." End of the transcript portion. There we have an example of the Federal Reserve, quote, kept out of politics, kept away from government management, which would not only be dangerous, but fatal. Barney Baruch, the New York stock plunger who never owned a bank in his life, was called up by Colonel E.M. House, the arch politician of the Wilson administration, and thus the great Federal Reserve Board was supplied another member. A telephone call kept within a narrow Jewish circle and settled by a word from one Jewish stock dealer, that, in a practical operation, was Mr. Warburg's great monetary reform. Mr. Baruch calling up Mr. Warburg to give the name of the next appointee of the Federal Reserve Board, and calling up Mr. McAdoo, Secretary of the United States Treasury, and set in motion to do it by Colonel E.M. House, a Jew. Is it any wonder the Jewish mystery in the American war government grows more and more amazing? But, as Mr. Warburg has written, quote, "friendship or help in a presidential campaign, financial or political, has always given a claim to political preferment." That is, you get the spoilage and the jobs when your guy wins. And, as Mr. Warburg urges, this is a country, quote, "with every untrained amateur a candidate for office, and naturally with such men comprising the government, they must be kept at a safe distance from monetary affairs." As if to illustrate the ignorance thus charged, along comes Mr. Baruch, who quotes Colonel House as saying, "I don't know anything about those fellows down there, and I would like you to make a suggestion." It is permissible to doubt that Mr. Baruch correctly quotes Colonel House. It is permissible to doubt that all Colonel House confessed was his ignorance about, quote, "those fellows." There was a good understanding between those two men, too good an understanding for the alleged telephone conversation to be taken strictly at its face value. It is possibly quite true that Mr. House is not a financier. Certainly Mr. Wilson was not. In the long roll of presidents, only a handful have been, and those who have been regarded as most drastic in their proposals. But this whole matter of ignorance, as charged by Mr. Warburg, sounds like an echo of the protocols. Quote, "The administrators chosen by us from the masses will not be persons trained for government, and consequently they will easily become pawns in our game, played by our learned and talented counselors, specialists educated from early childhood to administer world affairs." So this Jew who has been around the world, he's been in Germany, France, England, the US, China, India, and Russia, learning the banking ropes, is going to see even an American of the higher class and greater experience like President Wilson as a comparative rube and a child who needs to be handheld by Jews in order not to screw everything up. This is how Jews look at us, as children or livestock. In the 20th protocol, wherein the great financial plan of world subversion and control is disclosed, there is another mention of the ruler's ignorance of financial problems. It is a coincidence that, while he does not use the term ignorance, Mr. Warburg is quite outspoken concerning the benighted state in which he found this country, and he is also outspoken about the, quote, "untrained amateurs," unquote, who are candidates for every office. These, he says, are not fitted to take part in the control of monetary affairs. But Mr. Warburg is. He says so. He admits that it was his ambition from the moment he came here, an alien Jewish-German banker, to change our financial affairs more to his liking. More than that, he has succeeded. He has succeeded, he himself says, more than most men do in a lifetime. He has succeeded, Professor Seligman says, to such an extent that throughout history, the name of Paul M. Warburg and that of the Federal Reserve System shall be united. That's the end of chapter 59, and that appeared in the Dearborn Independent on the 2nd of July, 1921. So we see the whole story of the Federal Reserve there and how it was set up The Jews wanted to give the U.S. a central bank, and remember how strongly people resisted the central bank, at least the good side of American history. They completely resisted. Andrew Jackson actually succeeded in destroying the first central bank that we had. Central bank means counterfeiting, means the enslavement of the people. And you can believe that there's some kind of inherently good people out there who are going to run everything for the genuine interest, but you can't really trust that. Because even if you had, say, someone who was genuinely selfless to set up that system, the next guy in line is just as likely to be a criminal. That's the inherent problem of our white nature, if you don't want to say human nature, that there are no really good people in the sense of being completely honest. And the best you can do, if you try for the perfect or the ideal, you're going to do, the perfect is the enemy of the good in this instance. And you need to be humble enough to recognize the reality that people are going to steal. If you had access to a counterfeiting machine and there were no penalties for using it, you probably would use it, no matter how pure of heart you think you might be. So take that into account, and competition among currencies will keep it honest. Anyway, that's a long tranche we've done today of financial stuff, the financial chapters. I think there may be one or two more to go, but these were related, so we did them together, chapters 58 and 59 of The International Jew. And so I'll be back with you soon again, and we'll do some more. We've got another 20 chapters to go. But anyway, thanks for listening to me today, and I will be back with you again real soon.